Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber. Imagine being a teenager stuck in a hospital bed, unable to walk for 2 years after major surgery, staring out at a rugby field where you once dreamed of playing. For Chochi Milani, it was in this painful and isolating moment that music became a lifeline, and eventually a monument to who he is today. From his childhood in Fiji to global stages with Gang of Youths, and now creating opportunities for Pacific voices through his label Broth Records, Chochi's story is one of resilience, heritage, and building pathways for others. Chochi Milani, welcome to Stories from the Pacific.
Hello, Naka Bobby. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us more behind this story of you as a teenager in a hospital bed?
Yeah. I just started boarding school. I was in the 10th grade and away from my family the first time for like an extended period. And yeah, I'd had this kind of prolonged injury that stemmed back to when I was 18 months old. I had a infection in my right femur, a disease called osteomyelitis, which is more common in tropical environments and nations near the equator, and obviously Fiji being one of those nations. So I got to be a part of that lucky bunch, one in 200,000 that got this disease. And yeah, I still don't really know how it continued to affect me. It wasn't properly treated when I was a kid. So when I got to about 11, my right femur stopped growing, and I had to have a few surgeries to stop it worsening because this disease was eating away at my bone. And yeah, at 16, I had to have it lengthened quite a bit. And that just, you know, it improved my life, you know, maybe aesthetically, but you know, I aspired to be some form of athlete, and that kind of really hindered of my aspirations in that way.
I imagine it was pain that drew your attention to, you know, something needing to be done. How did you first realize that this pain was something more, that something needed to be done?
It wasn't really pain. I had these like odd occurrences that happened throughout my life. Like I'd wake up at night and feel my knee was like a glove, you know what I mean? Like it felt like a hand in there. So these odd kind of feelings, but I wouldn't exactly call it painful. It wasn't until I was about 11, my father was watching me run, and, you know, Islander dad calling out from the sideline, "Stop running funny," you know, and that just became this commentary that was running for a few weeks. He's like, "You really stop running funny." It's like, I don't know if it's a nervous tic or something. And I was like, I'm not trying to run funny. And he looked at my leg and saw that it was starting to become deformed.
Wow.
And that's when we noticed something was up.
So you're at this age when all of your friends are out playing sport. How did you deal with that emotionally, being unable to walk or run?
I wasn't in the position to mentally prepare for it. You know, culturally, like I had a lot of support, but no one prepares you for those, you know, how to deal with altering your aspirations. So it just happened. And I remember my father and the surgeon who operated on my leg colluding together to not tell me the full extent of what my life would look like for the next year. Because, you know, I would actually say that my father did the right thing, because I probably would have tried to run away. So I didn't know that I was going to have these rods sticking out of my leg and this massive contraption outside of my leg for 10 months of that year. So I woke up out of surgery and I fainted when I saw my leg. You know, I was just confronted with it. And so I didn't know what to do. No thought was cathartic. There was no process. I just grabbed the nearest thing to me at the time, you know, and I'm just really lucky that I was in an environment where the nearest thing to me then was a guitar. And that's when I really kind of dove headfirst more into music. I was already enthusiastic about music. I grew up in church and we sung and played in church, but this took it to a new level because I wasn't praising God anymore. You know, I was really outworking thoughts and feelings that I didn't know the language, you know, where language and feeling kind of stopped. It came out through my fingers. And yeah, that's, I guess, the first form of therapy I felt like I was exposed to.
Yeah. Can you tell us more about how grabbing that guitar influenced you in the future?
It just had to be constant, you know, because it's not like I could distract myself with anything else. Like when you're bedridden, you're bedridden. And, you know, I'm very grateful now that I'm fully abled and there are other people that don't get to move away from the bed. And I'm very conscious of that. But, you know, as a 15 going on 16 year old, it was very hard to kind of make sense of that situation. But aside from just having that guitar there, I'm really grateful to two relationships in particular at the time. I had a boarding house mate. He was a Sri Lankan kid. And, you know, we were just polar opposite kind of backgrounds. He's a Sri Lankan Muslim kid. We're still in touch now, actually, and he's married a Fijian, which is pretty cool. Really likes his Fijians. But, you know, he exposed me to so much music that I'd never been exposed to before. I had nothing else to do but to just, you know, indulge in all this stuff. And then during that time as well, I had the singer from my old band who'd come trek it from the inner west, and he'd sneak into school. And the nurses thought he was cute and really lovely and very endearing. So they'd allow him to sneak in and we'd just play guitar together. But those two relationships in particular really, really kind of sustained me and set me on this path of pursuing music.
Mm. Did your obsession with the guitar first begin in that hospital bed or was it elsewhere?
Definitely church started it. You know, I was really, really lucky that I was just from a young age kind of exposed to music gear. It wasn't just playing the guitar, you know, kind of like a car enthusiast. You get really into modifying and, you know, swapping parts out. So I love the whole modular nature of a guitar and guitar equipment and that never-ending pursuit of tone. You know, it's become almost like a second job to me. It still is. You know, it's the longest running job I've had, the pursuit of tone. But yeah.
You were an original band member of Gang of Youths. For our listeners who may not know this group, can you share a bit more about them?
Yeah. You know, we were just a bunch of kind of church rejects that started out in a West garage, a David's garage in Strathfield. And yeah, I don't know. There's just something when we were starting this whole thing, I don't mean to sound cocky, but we just knew we had it, you know, we just knew we had the talent, we had the songs, but beyond that we had the theme and the message that was driving us. Now, we grew up playing music in that church context where when you're exposed to music in that way, music doesn't exist without a purpose, right? In the context of religion and church, it's Christ-driven. But when we listen to other, you know, like secular music or music from other parts of the world, we always try to find, like, identify the Christ within it. You know, what's the Christ of this song? And for us at that time, not to sound make this a theme of idolatry, for any of our religious listeners listening. But you know, the thing that drove us at that point was the singer's partner at the time was terminally ill and had been given a set amount of time to live, which was only a few years. And we wanted to build like a monument to her. And I felt that was really special. I thought that was worth, you know, kind of putting aside other things to help pursue. Because even if it doesn't fail, you know, we really helped try to make something of someone before the eventual would have happened, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Can you tell us more about these ideas of monuments and how they have an influence in your life?
Yeah. I think there's two things that kind of influence that for myself, family and culture. Culturally, you know, being Fijian and like other Melanesian and Polynesian kind of communities is a big communal kind of mindset and collective kind of thinking where even in our ambition, you know, we're not driven by like kind of our personal agendas or desires. It's seen as like countercultural. It's always about the collective group and, you know, the group and the clan that I was a part of had this kind of mission statement and I kind of, you know, culturally kind of played into my desires and my ambition. And then also I think just with my family, I grew up, you know, my grandfather was a paramount chief of my region. And he always spoke of kind of giving back, you know, that whatever it is, go out and have your time, go out and have your education. And your education is not just university and school, but it's life experience. But that's, you know, that's all building you up to get to a point where you can come back and contribute to your homeland and to your community. And so, you know, I can remember that from the age of 4 and 5, you know, that always being driven to us, through us. And my father and my mother always reiterating that to us.
In what ways have you and your father and grandfather come back to community at the height of your own individual success?
Look, I'm very conscious this sounds like your kind of typical Islander uncle story, you know, where, oh, I could have been this, I could have been the president or prime minister. But, you know, I have kind of fact-checked this, but, you know, my uncle was who I'm named after, was a very promising rugby player in the 80s, and he captained the Punicky Wellington team, you know, played against the British Lions a bunch, was called up to the All Blacks, and my grandfather, his father, told him not to, you know. He said, like, you're going to pursue this whole other life that's going to take you away from your goal and you need to come back. And so, he came back and he's been operating as a doctor for many years back home. My father was an amateur heavyweight champion of New Zealand and, you know, was earmarked to go and, represent in the Olympics. And then the opportunity to move to Vegas to train and to develop and test himself against some of the world's best. And his father, you know, told him the same thing that he told my uncle, you know, that's going to lead you to this whole other life. My grandfather, also being a doctor, was conscious of the repercussions of, you know, these physical sports would have on your mental health and, you know, your physical health. So he kind of wasn't a fan of that. And, but ultimately it was about kind of serving the family and serving your nation.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber and I'm speaking with Chochi Malani. Chochi, what inspired you to found Broth Records?
Yeah, I mean, on that theme of monuments, you know, I remember just being, I think, like what was probably like a peak experience at Gangs at the time. Had been living in London for almost 5 years, and I was just in this room full of just crazy personalities. I won't even say it because it would just feel fake to say it, but just these people who like knew who we were and just enthusiastic about what we were doing. And I just kind of had this moment where I just thought, like, where does it go from here? And I don't know if it was my grandfather's spirit intervening at that point or something, but I just thought, like, all of this just feels so selfish for myself, right? I'm speaking purely, I guess, for my own self and my own ambitions and desires, but I just felt like, you know, this feels so foreign to me. The further I go down here, the further away I feel from home, and the home being Fiji and the islands. You know, one thing that I've loved about growing up here in Australia, and one thing I love about, you know, every time I've had the pleasure of being in New Zealand, is just how much of Polynesian presence and culture is there, and Melanesian presence and culture as well. And I really struggled with that in London. You know, I had a bunch of friends and family who had moved to Europe and were playing in league and union, and I'd make points to go and see them. And that was as much exposure as I kind of got. And I just thought, you know, if this is kind of the promised land for sports or media, you know, there isn't kind of like enough support. There isn't enough of a pathway. And I'm not saying the goal is to get to Europe or to get to the States, but I just thought, you know, I don't know. Not that I want us Pacific Islanders and, you know, to colonize the world, but I was like, I want to be in Norway and not feel like this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I made the decision. It just, everything kind of just fell into my mind, I guess, all within that day. I just kind of had this strong idea. I need to come home and I need to test myself, really. And yeah, I was thinking a lot about community, and I just thought, you know, romantically, like a label, having a label where gang of youths, you know, having two Pacific Islanders out of five, and, you know, a lot of kind of what we spoke about was our Pacifica upbringings and how that influenced our music, a world which is, you know, not at all occupied by other Pacific Islanders. And I just thought, how sad would it be if Gang of Youths is like the only success story out of that? You know, I don't even think we were the most talented people out of kind of the areas we grew up in. You know, we did work hard, but we were also very lucky, right time and place. And I just thought, you know, not to quote Ricky Gervais, you know, not on my watch. I wanted to come back here and just think, like, rather than building a monument to myself, I want to create more pathways for others. And I guess that's what led to what I'm doing now.
Mm. How has the business evolved since you started it?
Yeah, quite a bit. You know, it's less of a record label these days, because obviously, like, post-lockdown, the industry's changed a lot. How talent is developed, or if talent is developed at all, I could argue, is changed. Where the money kind of flows in music now is acquiring back catalog or signing up influencers, and major labels around the world removing A&R departments, you know, sacking senior A&R or moving them on into some kind of legacy unk kind of role, you know, where they're mentoring artists, but no one's actually developing artists. And I think it's really sad that it's happening at a time where diversity is kind of a really strong currency and it's being highlighted more, but ironically, we're having less accessibility into it. You know, there's more spotlighting for us, but there's kind of none of those steps to get up on the platform, if that makes sense. And yeah, I think this is something that I would just, yeah, I'm endeavoring to help solve, basically.
Can you clarify what an A&R department is?
Yeah, so artists and repertoire. So if you've ever watched any music movies, they're always the person from the label that comes in and it's like, oh, you know, this song should be shorter, or, you know, sometimes they're there helping an artist through a difficult point. And, you know, depending on the film, they can be depicted as good or as evil. And, you know, like any other industry, you know, it's like a doctor. You have a good doctor and a bad doctor, but ultimately you still need doctors. And, you know, I genuinely believe that about A&R. If we're not developing new talent, are we really an industry? You know, if you're just signing back catalog or signing up influencers, and that's the way that the current model works. Before they listen to your music, they look at how many followers, how much engagement, what's your brand engagement worth, and then they listen to your music, you know. And again, with the Ricky Gervais, not on my watch, you know, I just think there's just such a time, such an accessibility to just not just the ability to distribute music, but also the accessibility to like recording and instruments through the islands. And, you know, we're coming to a pivotal moment where we're seeing like an evolution, right? I really think that we are approaching the biggest leaps in Melanesian and Polynesian kind of music evolution. And the accessibility to a lot of what I just mentioned is a big part of that. And for that, you know, for new music to come through now and for it to be harder for these voices to cut through is just really sad to me. You know, I'm doing some work with my friends Alpha and Yuki there in Samoa, the Talanoa Arts Forum. And, you know, I've mentioned it to some people in the Pacific community here, but all the community radio stations in Samoa are privately owned, and they won't pay local artists if, you know, they want their music played. And if the local artists ask for money, they just won't play them. But what's happening now is it's created this totally unique way of sharing music and community where they have these car shows, like paint and audio clubs, I think they're called. And they go around in these cars, and they like artists will play their new music out of their done up cars, you know, and they spend so much money, and families from across the world like import cars. Like at this last year's major competition, they had Samoan families from Arizona, you know, importing cars. But this is the main way and the only way that community are sharing new music and local music, right? It's becoming so much harder to cut through. And whilst I think it's so cool that we're finding these new underground ways, which is true to kind of our way of sharing music, where it's, you know, community driven, it's just so sad that no one's hearing about these kind of things outside of Samoa. And, you know, there's so many similar stories all throughout the Pacific. And so, you know, I've partnered with a family office here, Boston Global. And, you know, they've been extremely supportive of my endeavors and really believe in what I'm doing in the Pacific. And they want to help support doing what I'm doing to help, you know, make these stories and these songs more accessible to the world.
Just taking a slight shift here, how has becoming a father changed the way that you approach music, business, and time?
Yeah. Look, you're talking to a Pacific Islander about time, you know? It's I didn't really understand, I guess, the definitive nature of time. And, you know, I think that was an asset to me in my youth, especially in my time in Gang of Youths. You know, that informed how I wrote, informed how I played, how I designed sound, you know. Having that kind of relaxed approach. But, you know, I think I was too kind of reliant on the community, you know, as we're kind of brought up to think of, you know, like you just trust the process is something that kind of really resonates in my community. And whilst it was beneficial in some ways, I think it took me a long time to execute on a lot of ideas and just you know, even with starting a business. But my goodness, having a daughter, and I'm so glad I had a daughter, by the way. I could not imagine having a son. And I'm sorry if I have a son in the future and you hear this. I accept you for who you are, but you know, if I have more kids, I would love to just have girls. You know, I just think I just think they're amazing. I grew up with four sisters, but now as a businessman, you know, I've really learned the value of my time and how to charge for my time, just something I really struggled with before. You know, I'm very guilty of having done a lot of stuff for free in my past, just for the love of it. But you know, now any time away from my daughter, I got to charge for it, you know, because yeah, any moment away from her, they grow so quickly, you know, and I want to be able to contribute to her future if I'm not there with her in person. And so, yeah, now I'm $9,000 an hour. She's going to need that money.
What an incredible future your daughter's going to have. Yeah. Georgie, have you ever asked yourself what monument will you leave behind? How do you answer that today?
Yeah, I am of the belief that you only get one go. You know, in my current work, I'm around some incredible people, and there's a gentleman, Peter Sagin, that I work with right now, and you know, with launching new stuff, he always tells me you only get one go, one chance to go through the process. And you know, for me, once I'm gone, I'm gone, and I don't want the weight of who I was or what I've done, good or bad. You know, who knows what I'll get up to towards the end of my life, but I'm endeavoring to stay on the straight and narrow. You know, whatever it is, let's just presume that I've maintained the good progress that I've built up already. I don't want that weight bearing on my kids, you know, and any future generations. And, you know, I don't want it to feel like pressure to them in any kind of way. I felt like I grew up with that. You know, whether this pressure to be like a certain level, not just to succeed. Succeeding wasn't good enough. It was like I had to get to the same caliber. You know, I came from a family of very high achievers. And whilst I want my child and, you know, my future generations to do really well, I would love for them to create their own legacy within their own lifetime, as I will do, you know, myself. And yeah. The best monument you can build is, I guess, yeah, the ones you see in your lifetime. But, you know, sometimes it'll take three generations to build something. You know, what I'm endeavoring to do in the Pacific, I might not work out in my lifetime, and that's fine. But, you know, there'll be lots of little other cool stuff that I'll get to be a part of. I've already done a lot of great stuff. I'm very proud of Gang of Youths and, you know, what that means to my family and my community. But yeah. Yeah, it's not a bad monument already.
Oh, Chachi, incredible story. Thank you so much for joining me from Sydney and for sharing how your journey has moved from Fiji to world stages and now back home to create pathways for Pacific voices in music and beyond. So congratulations and thank you for joining me.
Not a problem. Thank you very much, Bobby.
That was Chachi Milani, musician, producer and founder of Broth Records. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Bobby McCumber. To hear more stories about unique and incredible people from the Pacific, just search for Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. If you or someone you know has an interesting story to share, you can email us at storiesfromthepacific@abc.net.au. This story was produced on the lands of the Yuggera and Turrbal people. I'm hosting this story on the lands of the Kaurna people.